ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Kylie Morris, and this is the Radio National Hour, coming to you from the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation in Sydney. Coming up, when good neighbours become good friends. Australia and Indonesia agree on a new defence treaty on common security, described by the Prime Minister as a watershed moment. Also ahead, will they, won't they? The Liberals have spent a marathon 5 hours thrashing it out over net zero in Canberra today, amid growing speculation the target, and possibly even the party's leader, Susan Lee, could be dumped. The National Affairs Editor for The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald, James Masola, joins me. And what's the most likely course for climate change now? A new report from the International Energy Agency says the world is already on track to exceed 1.5 degrees of warming, and that demand for oil and coal could continue to grow into the 2050s. From uneasy neighbours to strategic partners, Australia and Indonesia have today entered what Prime Minister Anthony Albanese calls a new era, a watershed moment in regional diplomacy. Standing alongside visiting Indonesian President Prabowo Subianto in Sydney, the Prime Minister has unveiled a historic bilateral security treaty to be signed in January that commits both countries to consult at the highest levels and even consider joint action if either is threatened.
Australia's relationship with Indonesia is based on friendship, trust, mutual respect, and a shared commitment to peace and stability in our region.
We cannot choose our neighbours, especially countries like us. It is our destiny to be direct neighbours. So let us face our destiny with the best of intentions.
Warm words from both leaders there. It's the first agreement of its kind between the two countries and builds on last year's defence cooperation agreement. But the announcement also comes at a sensitive time for Indonesia's leader, just days after naming his former father-in-law and former president Suharto a national hero. Rahman Yaakob is a security and defence expert and academic advisor at the ASEAN Australia Defence Programme at the ANU, and Ken Setiawan is a senior lecturer in Indonesian Studies and deputy director of the Asia Institute at Melbourne University. Welcome both of you to the Radio National Hour.
Thank you for having us.
Rahman, Anthony Albanese says this is a watershed moment. There's not too much detail that's been made public at this stage about the planned treaty, but do we know how it might change the current defence relationship?
Yes. I think the most interesting word that Albanese mentions was trust between Australia and Indonesia. At this point in time, the trust level, I would say, is not that high. Basically, there's a strategic mistrust, lack of trust between Indonesia and Australia. I give you two points, actually. One is the Australians' military intervention in Timor-Leste, and the second one is the tapping of the former Indonesian president's handphone, President SBY. So these two incidents, this was pointed out to me by senior Indonesian defense officials. These two incidents actually led Indonesia to have a bit of a negative perception and distrust of Australia.
Rahman, you were meeting with Indonesian defence officials on the sidelines of the Manila dialogue a few days ago. What would the general's view, do you think, be of an agreement that commits both countries to consult at a leader and ministerial level on a regular basis?
Yes, I think from the Indonesian perspective, this is a very positive development. It set up some kind of a mechanism and a platform for defence officials to actually interact much more closely with each other. In fact, the wording of this, the statement that has been released, when I look at it, it is quite close or almost similar to the Five Power Defence Arrangement, FPDA, that Australia has with Singapore and Malaysia. you know, to consult each other in the event of crisis. So I think it reflects an effort by the Australia to build up strategic trust with the Indonesian counterparts.
Yeah, I guess to bring them into line with our relationships with Malaysia and Singapore. I mean, the agreement commits both nations not only to consult, but also to consider joint action if either faces a threat. Now, that feels reminiscent of something like NATO's mutual defence clause. I mean, how significant is that kind of language between Canberra and Jakarta?
Yes, but I think it's quite significant in a sense that it demonstrates Jakarta's willingness to work closely with Australia despite that strategic mistrust. I think it demonstrates an effort by the Jakarta officials of the Indonesian side that, look, as what Indonesian President Prabowo said, we can't choose our neighbour. We have to work with our neighbour. And I think this is a positive direction.
Both countries, of course, have long emphasised regional stability. But stability, I guess, can mean very different things, can't they, to Canberra and to Jakarta. So what kind of stability is this treaty really designed to protect, do you think?
I think first and foremost, it is to address Jakarta concerns, especially with the recent Papua New Guinea and Australia defence agreement. So having a similar kind or having this agreement with Jakarta, it will address Jakarta's suspicions about the Australia-Papua New Guinea PNG defence relations. That's the first one. Second one, there's a major issue in terms of West Papua. Jakarta's security concerns is its sovereignty over West Papua. Basically, the Indonesian officials are concerned that the US Marines deployed in Darwin could be used to intervene in West Papua. And having this kind of agreement between Australia and Indonesia will somehow address that Jakarta concerns over West Papua. So again, I think it is a positive step, but it's not the only steps.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour with me, Kylie Morris, and my guests are security and defence expert Rahman Yaqob and Ken Setiawan, who's the Deputy Director of the Asia Institute at Melbourne University. Ken, President Prabowo, of course, has a military background himself and indeed was accused in the past of human rights abuses and war crimes during the Suharto regime. He was even banned from the US at one stage. Just seeing him standing alongside Anthony Albanese, you know, with Sydney Harbour in the background today, is his rebranding now complete, do you think?
Look, if you look at the way that Prabowo Subianto was received today by Australia, it was obviously a very warm welcome. I think it is correct what happened today. It actually falls into a broader pattern where Prabowo Subianto has really gone to great lengths to rebrand himself. And I think this current treaty serves to improve his image. But as we know, Prabowo was discharged from the Indonesian military in 1998 for his role in the abduction of pro-democracy activists, many of whom remain missing today. An investigation from the National Human Rights Commission in 2005 actually established that he was responsible for those disappearances. And as you mentioned, he was for many years banned from entering the United States. And I think it's also important to state that it's not just about human rights violations of the past. We have seen in recent protests against the Prabowo government that rights groups have reported that many people went missing. Actually, just a few days ago, the remains of two missing protesters were found. And there was also a very harsh response from the security forces during those protests. We've also seen an increased militarization under the Prabowo presidency, increased land conflicts. The human rights situation in West Papua is particularly concerning. And the signing of that treaty deflects from all of those issues and, of course, the heated debate around conferring national hero status to former President Suharto.
Ken, let's talk about that. So a few days ago, President Prabowo announced that he decided to officially name former President Suharto an Indonesian national hero. So this was in commemoration of Heroes Day in Indonesia. What's your reaction to Suharto being officially named Indonesia's national hero?
Well, I think, you know, the human rights abuses that occurred under Suharto's new order are very well documented. The new order was born from violence. It was built on a genocide. And the patterns that we saw during that violence in the 1960s were actually replicated by the Indonesian military under Suharto's responsibility across the new order. And in addition to those human rights abuses, the regime was characterized by rampant corruption, nepotism, and censorship. Now, those that makes, of course, that the conferral of national hero status is very problematic, and certainly is also very painful for people that have experienced those violations, that have survived them, their family members, as well as the work of many rights groups and academics that have worked very, very hard to uncover those abuses.
I wonder, does it also mean potentially that, you know, those protesters and activists who've been jailed since Prabowo's swearing in last year, the intimidation of journalists, the civics, the shrinking civic space, I mean, the elevation of Suharto potentially sends the message, doesn't it, that those tactics are once again politically acceptable?
Definitely. The conferring national hero status to Suharto actually glosses over, completely ignores the human rights violations of that time. It legitimizes those abuses. And that also, you know, has an impact on what is happening today.
Rahman, for Australia, what do you think? How much of this move, this defense treaty, is about managing China's growing influence in the region? And how much of it is about that issue that you mentioned earlier, reinforcing trust with Jakarta as Prabowo leans into his presidency?
I think to a major extent, it is firstly, the important thing is to address Jakarta security concerns toward Australia. I think Indonesia is the most immediate neighbour of Australia, which is quite strategic in its importance. And I think that's the reason why I believe that this agreement is actually primarily driven by the need to maintain a good relationship with Indonesia. And of course, the secondary factor is the China factor. I think this is, based on my assessment, this is the drivers that actually shape the defense agreement at this point in time.
On that note, what are the likely regional reactions to this, do you think, Rahman? I mean, is it likely to be received positively by other Southeast Asian nations, perhaps not so positively in Beijing?
Okay, that's a very good question. Generally, what is good for Indonesia, I think, is good for Southeast Asia, because Jakarta is seen as the ASEAN big brother. Generally, I think Malaysia, Singapore, the Philippines will welcome this agreement. It will basically attract, or I would say, bring in or cement Australia strategic presence in Southeast Asia. I don't think any Southeast Asian country will be very concerned about this defense agreement. On the other hand, certain major power, Beijing, for example, will be concerned. Is Australia trying to counter China with this agreement? Which I think the Chinese will think so, based on my recent engagement with them in the Manila dialogue. So looking at the whole big picture, I believe that there will be less pushback from Southeast Asian country, a bit of pushback from Beijing, but I don't think Beijing will come down hard on Indonesia, because from Beijing perspective, Jakarta is an important player in this part of the world, and they do not want to offend Jakarta.
This is the Radio National Hour, and I'm speaking with security and defence expert Rahman Yaakob from the ANU and Indonesia politics expert Ken Sasiawan from the Asia Institute in Melbourne. Ken, I was just reflecting on what President Prabowo said as he was standing alongside Anthony Albanese, this line that, you know, you can't choose your neighbours, but we're kind of in this together. You know, that we should make the best of it because here we are. I mean, there's another expression about neighbours, which is that good fences make good neighbours. I guess, is it a positive development that Indonesia and Australia seem to be coming to some kind of mutual accommodation through this treaty?
Well, this definitely, you know, it's a positive step in the Australia-Indonesia relationship. But as I said before, we cannot really separate this also from what is happening in Indonesia itself, and particularly from the human rights situation. And that includes, you know, the recent controversy around the national hero status, but really also other human rights concerns.
Rahman, for you, more broadly, what does this moment reveal about Indonesia's direction under President Prabowo?
I think it's quite consistent with Prabowo's foreign policy objective, basically to broaden its defence partnership, its strategic partnership with as many powers as possible. To be honest, I will not be surprised if Prabowo signed a defence agreement with Russia or with China, even though the quality of it might be a bit different compared to the one with the US or with Australia. I think Prabowo, to my understanding, is keen to project Indonesia as a major power of its own beyond ASEAN. So I would suggest Canva not to be alarmed if Indonesia actually signed defence agreement with certain powers that Australia does not see eye to eye with.
Perhaps this is a treaty of reassurance. Ken, can I just finish by asking you what you think this moment reveals about President Prabowo and the direction he's taking Indonesia in?
Well, I think the treaty really serves to improve Prabowo Subianto's image. It positions him extremely well on the international stage. And that, of course, the signing of the treaty between Australia and Indonesia also further reiterates that this pragmatic approach to the relationship is important to both countries.
Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you.
Rahman Yaacob is a security and defence expert and academic advisor at the ASEAN Australia Defence Programme at ANU. And Ken Satyawan is a senior lecturer in Indonesian Studies and deputy director of the Asia Institute at Melbourne University. Coming up, even as the great and the good of the Liberal Party debate the future of net zero targets, the International Energy Agency delivers its World Energy Outlook. And spoiler alert, it's not looking good. Oh, to have been a fly on the wall. The Liberal Party spent 5 hours locked in a party room meeting today, thrashing it out over net zero, with a majority of members reportedly voicing a desire to dump the 2050 target. The issue came to a head 10 days ago when the National Party announced they were ditching the policy platform, forcing the Liberal leader, Susan Lee, to schedule an urgent caucus meeting for today. She says it went well. The Shadow Minister for Energy and Emissions, Dan Tehan, addressed the media afterwards.
There was very, very passionate discussions in the room because energy and emissions reduction is an issue that everyone cares deeply about. And the overwhelming thing that came out of the meeting for me was that everyone wants to make sure that our policy, our energy policy and our emissions reduction policy is in the national interest. That became incredibly clear.
What's not yet incredibly clear is where the Liberals will ultimately land. According to Dan Tehan, all will be revealed by midday tomorrow. For more on what's transpired today, I'm joined by James Masola, the National Affairs Editor for The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. James, I know it's an incredibly busy afternoon for you, so thank you for joining us and welcome back to the Radio National Hour.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.
This was a marathon meeting. I would hate to have been the one taking minutes. I want to get into the details, but firstly, what's your understanding of how many were for and how many were against dumping net zero targets?
Yeah, so I'm told by a person or a couple of people, in fact, who are in the room, that it was 28 people speaking in favour of dumping the commitment, 17 speaking in favour of keeping it, and four, it wasn't really clear whether they were for or against the policy, as in retaining the policy. The nuance in that, I think, is about, and indeed there was detailed discussion as well about, okay, so most of us think we should get, or a majority rather, think we should get rid of it. But what about this idea of keeping an aspiration towards 2050 net zero at some point in time in the next, in this century, for example? There was a bit more line ball, but it was pretty clear that the current settings aren't going to be kept.
So potentially a shift then towards an aspirational policy rather than a fixed target.
Yeah, that's correct. And look, I'll be honest, we don't have a lot of detail about the meeting. That aspirational, that idea rather of an aspiration, that may not be, that might be too far for some of the conservatives in the room too. Like, this is very much not settled. That's one of the options. And we, in theory, should find out more details tomorrow. But then to further complicate it all, Liberals and Nationals are meeting on Sunday as well to then kind of, I guess the word is harmonise their position. So maybe we'll get a new position again on Sunday.
we had Dan Tehan talking there, and he said that he had offered some guiding principles ahead of the meeting. Do we know at least how the meeting was set up, how it started?
Yeah, no, we do. So he sort of began the meeting. People spoke in alphabetical order. There were 49 people out of the 51-member party room who spoke. The only two who didn't were Tehan and Susan Lee. Lee's going to speak, publicly as well tomorrow, but also in the meeting of Liberal ministers when they get together around 9 a.m. I gather it was a respectful meeting, but it certainly hasn't gone the way that Susan Lee and the moderates would have wanted. I don't think that's over-egging it to say that at all.
No, it was interesting. I think the only quote I've seen from Susan Lee is her saying that it went well. So that's, who knows what that really meant.
Yeah, I mean, just a flesh wound.
Yes. Let's talk about some of the speakers, and I understand there were a lot of them. I mean, the Liberal Party director, Andrew Hirst, spoke quite early on. Do we know what his message was?
Yeah, so he basically outlined internal polling that's setting out this is what the community's views are on net zero. Broadly speaking, people are in favour of, you know, effective climate action. Where it gets a bit trickier and where there's potentially an opportunity for opponents of net zero is that when you reframe the debate around, okay, you're in favour of net zero, but that means your household is going to spend $800 a year to sort of meet your commitments, or $1,000 a year, or $10,000, not that any of those figures are on the table, but reframe it around affordable power, then there's a window of opportunity, is what he said to the party room today.
So there are points of persuasion, he would have told them.
Yeah, exactly. But that being said, you actually have to kind of... you have to seize that opportunity. You have to sell that message. You actually, reframing the debate, you don't just say, I'm reframing the debate. You have to convince Australians, who our polling shows, other polls show, by and large, support action to mitigate the effects of climate change.
And I understand that Sarah Henderson and Michaela Cash both pushed back against their director. What were their arguments? Do you know?
Yeah, in the broad, what they were arguing, unfortunately I wasn't in the room. I would have loved to have been. In the broad, their arguments are, they were questioning the polling and saying, actually, you know, I don't necessarily believe that that's right, and I think you're framing it the wrong way. Almost a sort of a supposition on their part, if you like, that maybe, you know, Mr. Hirst is putting his finger on the scale in favour of retaining the policy. I'm not suggesting that's correct, just that to me seems to be what their belief or the point of their interventions was, essentially.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour, and I'm speaking with the National Affairs Editor for Nine Papers, James Masolo. James, Andrew Hastie, I understand, also proposed a strategy for bringing the electorate along on this process at the next election. So he went further, perhaps, than the director did. What was that about?
So he made the point that, you know, we can still win the next election, bearing in mind, of course, the Liberals have 43 lower house seats and need 33 more for a majority. It's a big task. Mm. But he said, look, we can still win. If we then achieve that victory, we then take, or rather put, you know, the enabling legislation for the net zero commitment, other climate legislation, if we put it to the Senate and they knock it back, we should go to a double dissolution and essentially have a referendum on net zero with the Australian people. Now, in one sense, that makes sense, of course. If, you know, if the Senate blocks a bill or a piece of legislation, the option is there after 3 months, two no votes, to go to a double D. But I think he's, well, how do I put this politely? Maybe putting the cart a bit before the horse, insofar as the Liberals face a pretty tough fight, or the coalition faces a pretty tough fight.
It's a pretty robust suggestion, isn't it, to kind of go,
exactly,
you know, head towards a double dissolution at this point. I mean, another leadership aspirant, Victorian MP Tim Wilson, proposed a new net zero model altogether. What was he arguing for?
Wilson's argument is, and has been for several months, net zero price increases first. He believes that we as a country need to remain committed to net zero. He lives, he's one of the few Liberals with an urban seat or a metropolitan seat where there is pretty strong support for action to mitigate climate change, for keeping the net zero target. So his argument was rather along those lines. The stuff he's been saying publicly for months about we need to put prices at the top of the sort of priority list, you know, keeping prices down, reducing power prices, and reframing the argument that way, which in a funny way is exactly what Andrew Hastie, who's way over on the other side of the political spectrum within the party room, he's saying the same thing. Let's make it about cheaper electricity.
I mean, does Tim Wilson talking about this in a way carry weight because he retook a teal seat, you know, beating Zoe Daniel in Goldstein, that he's someone who exists in a metropolitan sphere?
Yeah. No, look, that's exactly right. It does carry, I believe, additional weight. And he's not saying, not by any means, we should just copy whatever Labor's doing. He's saying, let's get prices down. Let's keep on the trajectory that we've committed to, but let's do it smarter because we're Liberals and we're smarter and we can manage this. And, you know, we can, I mean, I presume it would mean more gas being used in the system in the short term, more spending on solar. He's obviously a nuclear supporter, nuclear power supporter. It would mean opening the door to that by removing the moratorium on that industry. It'd be that sort of offering that Wilson's focused on.
Interestingly, not so much a reframing, but kind of a restarting a different kind of a conversation by the sounds of things. Can we talk about the Nats briefly? I mean, there was some talk late yesterday that Matt Canavan, the National Senator, might actually join the meeting today. I'm guessing that didn't happen and only Liberal Party members were present.
That's right. Matt's a very committed anti-net zero campaigner. I'm not surprised if he did want to join.
He wasn't trying to climb in any windows at any point.
No,
I didn't see him.
Okay.
Have we heard from any of the Nats today, James, about this meeting and how it might impact the coalition? I mean, you mentioned they've got another meeting together on Sunday.
Yeah. No, look, I mean, after... In a remarkable turn of events, I can't remember any Nationals MP saying anything on the record today, which has not been the case for the last few months. They really have sort of sat back and let the Liberals duke it out today, which I think is appropriate. And I think they can do that because, much like The Voice, they've brought the Liberal Party almost, and I think we'll get there, to the Liberal Party adopting the Nationals' position on a contentious issue.
It does feel as though the Nats, you know, might see this as they're forcing the agenda for the Liberals. You know, they've shifted their conversation toward the position they themselves hold. And at the same time, they've destabilised the leadership of Susan Lee. Is that an outcome they want?
I honestly don't think they care. I think in opposition, there's a lot more of that kind of every man, every woman, every party for themselves attitude. And they have, for whatever reason, a very strong belief in opposing net zero, the Nationals MPs, I mean. And I think that they want to keep the coalition, but they want it to look the way they want it to look, if that makes sense. They want to shape the direction of the coalition. And by going first, that's what they've managed to do. And it's a sort of a question of come what may for Susan Lee. I don't think it matters to them.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour and I'm speaking with the National Affairs Editor for Nine Papers, James Mazzola. Dan Tehan told the media that we'll know the formal policy position by midday tomorrow. So what's meant to happen between now and then? Are things resolved or is this going to be a night of frenetic phone calls and further conversation?
Look, there's a couple of things. I was at that presser. Dan also mentioned that he would be literally writing a shadow cabinet submission tonight on net zero and the way forward. So he used that as a reason to only take a few questions. So a lot of work on his part, and I suspect, you know, there'll be some people in the opposition leader's office too, working late into the night, including probably Susan Lee herself. What's happening now? I've just done a lap of the building and there are a bunch of meetings, moderates gathering and conservatives gathering to kind of assess the fallout and work out where it goes from here.
Is there more debate expected within the shadow cabinet meeting tomorrow or is that more likely to be then a rubber stamping of whatever Dan Tehan's writing up tonight?
I don't think it'll be a rubber stamping. There'll be at least a couple of people with very strongly held views on either side who will want to have more to say. Certainly on the moderate side, I mean, it looks like they're going to lose this argument and that the policy will be significantly watered down at a minimum. So, you know, I expect a bit of a rearguard action in the shadow ministry meeting tomorrow. But I don't think that it will necessarily stop this going ahead, stop this happening.
And once this policy is announced, James, and if the targets are dumped, what happens? Like, I'm wondering about how Liberal members in metropolitan seats might sell this, because there is a risk, isn't there, that regardless of how it ends, they'll be tarred with this kind of climate denial brush, which we know doesn't play very well in Australian cities.
Yeah, no, look, that's precisely right. There has been some discussion about, I think the form of words was along the lines of allowing moderates to speak in a positive fashion about all the great plans the Liberals have, or the Coalition has rather, to tackle climate change. So allowing them to lean into the fact that they're for tackling climate change, but probably not letting them use the words net zero, but maybe letting them use the words net zero, but probably not. Like, it really is that ridiculous. I don't know where we go from here, to be
maybe,
honest.
Maybe leaning into the aspiration.
Yeah, exactly. It seems a bit absurd to me.
I wonder whether this climate denial brush, though, is a likely tactic for the Albanese government to deploy. I mean, or is there a chance, and I'm curious about this, James, is there a chance that this debate within the Liberal Party allows a rethink or creates space for a different kind of conversation within the Labor Party room?
Oh, I'm not sure what you mean by that. Like, a conversation driving towards what, for example? Greater climate action? Or?
Yeah, I mean, on the right of the Labor Party or the centrists who are concerned about job losses connected to net zero targets.
Yep.
Does this open the door for them to say, well, look, maybe this is a mainstream view now?
Yeah, no, look, it absolutely does. And, you know, there is a cost of moving towards net zero, and it does grow. We know that from the Climate Change Authority's report a couple of months ago. At the moment, Australia's got a target of 43% reduction by 2030. We're probably going to hit, the estimate is, according to government, around 42%. Some people quibble with that figure. We're then trying to get to, 62 to 70% by 2035. On the current trajectory, we're going to hit 51. So we need to do more. You know, we need to be buying EVs, or, you know, installing new solar generating plants or wind towers, or really all three of them plus more. And that's going to cost money, because rolling out electricity lines costs money. So that's there is the potential for unrest with this policy. I think the Liberals are sensible to identify that. And yes, there's a possibility that this starts to, like, electricity prices starts to hurt Labor in 12 to 18 months' time, particularly if inflation continues to refuse to come down.
I mean, there was a public opinion survey released today, published in your paper, that suggests 31% of those polled think Australia should abandon the 2050 target and indeed treat it as an aspiration rather than a target. Is that the kind of polling? I mean, you referenced earlier the kind of polling that might have been shared with the party in the room today. Is that the kind of figures that they might have been thinking, you know, means it's worth taking on net zero targets again?
Yeah, look, it's pretty rare for public polling and private polling on the same topic, you know, when you're asking in a similar way, to be vastly different from each other, if you like. Obviously, there was a bit of an issue with some polling at the last election for the Liberal Party, which may have contributed to the defeat, may not have. But generally speaking, yes, the numbers are going to be pretty similar. And just on that poll, I wrote that story. I think it was 26% support sticking to the net zero by 2050 target, 28% want it as an aspiration and support it broadly, but don't want it to be legally binding. And then, you had 31% either wanting us to only do the minimum or to junk it and basically do nothing, and 15% undecided. So there is some fertile soil there to till, potentially, for both sides over the next 3 years.
So much has been made of this testing of Susan Lee's leadership, finally, James. I mean, if she holds on through this week, is she stronger or weaker? I mean, does this satisfy the right wing of the party that they've forced this rethink of net zero and that might in turn keep her job safe?
I think it keeps her job safe for a few months. From talking to conservatives who are not big Susan Lee fans, their bottom line is that she's, you know, a lot of them don't want her to succeed. They don't want her to be leader. So I think even if this is dealt with as it sort of kind of maybe sort of seems to be being dealt with, I don't think this issue is going to go away. You could look at those numbers today in terms of supporting or opposing net zero as a proxy vote on support or opposition to Susan Lee. I think the Conservatives certainly are looking at it like that. And they're, you know, frankly, rubbing their hands in glee, with glee. And I'll just finish on this thought. Something a Liberal said to me, a moderate said to me a day or so ago, what was the point of making Susan the leader if we're going to end up with the National Party's climate policy? So there's some anger in the moderates as well at this prospective, you know, or likely back down.
James, what a day. Thank you so much again for making the time and for helping us understand what went down in that room.
Yeah, an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me. Yep.
James Masola is the National Affairs Editor for The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. You're listening to the Radio National Hour. Now, on the day that Conservatives make their net zero decision, the Global Energy Authority in Paris has this afternoon released its World Energy Outlook. The annual report by the International Energy Agency, or IEA, is a touchstone document that projects possible scenarios for the kind of energy we consume, the security of our energy systems, what emissions might look like, and how these industries might develop. The report doesn't favour one projection over another, but does make for an intriguing reading. Here to discuss what we can learn from that is Josh Runciman, a lead analyst with the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis. Josh, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Good evening.
Let's start with this report itself. As I understand it, there are two main scenarios. Can you explain how they differ?
So the report has three sort of key scenarios. There is a new one from last year.
Right.
So it has a scenario that's based on current policy settings, a scenario that's based on what countries say they're going to do in order to meet emissions reduction targets, and then a policy that would effectively represent net zero by 2050 being achieved globally.
And what are the headlines in terms of their findings? Sorry, I know it's an impossibly long report, but was there anything in particular that struck you?
One of the things that really struck me actually is that even under a net zero scenario, the report is effectively predicting that we are going to overshoot the Paris target of 1.5 degrees of warming, which to me is one, obviously a reflection of the fact that we haven't made as much progress as we should be, but two is really quite concerning, and I think it really highlights the need for more action. A couple of other things that I took away from the report is under the current policy scenario, the International Energy Agency is projecting the oil, coal and natural gas demand are going to continue to increase, with coal expected to peak by 2030, but oil and natural gas demand is expected to increase all the way out to 2050.
So is this the current policies scenario that you're referring to?
Yeah.
And it, as I understand it, suggests that fossil fuels industries don't peak as soon as expected, that we might have to rely on them for electricity production at a high cost well into the future. Is that your reading of it?
Yeah.
So under that scenario, there is no way, it seems, that we could reach zero emissions targets and keep the temperature lower than Paris targets.
No. So the report's current policy scenario really forecasts increasing use of fossil fuels, oil and natural gas predominantly, out to 2050. Coal is expected to peak by 2030. This is a real shift from the forecast last year. I do want to note, though, that I mean, this is just a scenario, and in my view, a highly questionable scenario. For instance, when we look at the projections of natural gas demand out to 2050 from the IEA report, and we compare that with, say, Shell's forecasts or BP's forecasts, we see the IEA's numbers are actually much, much higher. Similarly, if we look at, say, oil demand, BP actually expect oil demand to peak this decade, whereas the International Energy Agency expects it to keep increasing all the way out to 2050. So I think that the current policy scenario is quite surprising in the magnitude of fossil fuel demand growth over the next two decades. But to me, it's actually quite questionable.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because the current policy scenario was an exploration, a projection that the agency used to investigate and explore. But they had been criticised, I think, up until 5 years ago, that that model, if you like, prioritised fossil fuel industries and underestimated the impacts of renewables. So they stopped producing that scenario. But this year, it's come back again. Do you understand why the agency made that decision?
So it does feel like some of the external pressure, and particularly from the United States, has worked its way into some of the analysis within the report, at least in my opinion. So when I saw the current policy scenario, I thought that that was effectively a response to that pressure.
I mean, you're not alone in that. Bill Hare, who's a CEO of Climate Analysis, is pretty clear on why he thinks it's back. He attributes it to pressure, he says, from the Trump administration. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think that's a fair assessment, yeah.
I mean, it's pure coincidence that this report is coming out the same day as the Liberal Party has been debating net zero. But what relevance does this report from the agency have for that debate?
I suspect that in publishing a current policy scenario that shows that emissions will continue to increase and fossil fuel use will continue to increase, that may embolden, I guess, the more conservative wing of the Liberal Party to argue that Australia's net zero commitments either aren't realistic or that they're not likely to be cost effective.
Josh Runciman is with me on the Radio National Hour, and we're discussing the International Energy Agency's annual report. More broadly, there's a public opinion survey in Australia that's out today that reveals 31% of those surveyed, Josh, think we should abandon the 2050 target and treat it as an aspiration. But just looking at this projection from the agency, it feels as though, based on their data, there might be reason to hold our nerve after all, if not by 2050. I mean, they spin it out to 2100, but say by then there is evidence that net zero policies might hold temperatures below 1.5 degrees. Is that a scenario that you're persuaded by?
I think that if we take a step back and look at the debate here in Australia, the debate around net zero, in my view, is more a debate around the economic aspects of it. On one side, energy prices, and then on the other side, and this doesn't get enough discussion at all, you know, what are the economic costs of inaction? Now, on the energy price side, I think that there's this incorrect belief that renewables are responsible for pushing up electricity prices. That's not really the case, of course. You know, we know renewables are cheaper. We are in a transition, and then as coal plants get older, they become less reliable, they break down more often, that obviously pushes up electricity prices. But then if you also look at gas prices in Australia and then you look at electricity prices, they're highly correlated. And so really what we are actually seeing is that as gas is being called on more and more to back up renewables, that's actually pushing up electricity prices. So really the key here isn't to back away from net zero. It's to look at our energy settings and our electricity mix and try to minimise the role of gas as much as possible while also trying to bring down the gas price. So the Australian government is currently looking at gas market policy settings. Most Australians on the East Coast support some form of gas reservation, and the government's looking at that. That will undoubtedly make a difference. Then on the other side, and a country like Australia is really exposed here, because we export so much of our agricultural product, and that's a big part of our economy, climate change really does threaten, you know, quite a bit of our agricultural production. There are regional aspects to this as well in terms of, you know, incomes in our regional areas and all of those sorts of things. So I think really the debate around net zero, to me seems a bit misguided, because it's ultimately a debate around electricity prices. And unfortunately, I'm not sure that we're having a really evidence-informed debate.
On the Radio National Hour, you're hearing Josh Runciman of the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis. Josh, I'm interested to hear what you think of this. So writing for Bloomberg about this annual report, columnist Javier Blas writes, and here's a quote, "For now, the world isn't performing an energy transition, but an energy addition, where renewables top up oil, gas and coal. Regardless of well-intended green aspirations," he writes, that will remain the case for years, if not decades, unless governments impose significant changes. Hope, he says, isn't a policy. What do you make of that?
So, look, it's an argument I've heard before, and to some extent it has been true. I think the question is, when we look forward, is that likely to continue for a long time or not? And I think, I mean, you know, we are in a transition. It does take time. And to be fair, I think Javier does have a bit of a point. But then I take a step back and I look at, say, countries like Pakistan that I think really indicate the potential. Pakistan is a country with, you know, really poor electricity reliability and electricity supply, credit constrained, and really exposed to high commodity prices. So Pakistan relies on imported LNG in order to run its electricity system. What we've seen over the past 2 years is, even without government subsidies and without any government support, that actually Pakistan has imported a huge amount of solar panels, enough panels in the past few years to effectively generate one third of its electricity. And so there's been this real ground up revolution in terms of households buying panels on their own. They're now starting to put in place batteries. That's creating some challenges for the grid in Pakistan. But I think that that's a real sign of actually the relative cost benefits of renewables, particularly with China producing so many cheap panels. So it's a real indication of the benefits of renewables versus, say, LNG, which tends to be quite expensive. I think when we look, say, across Asia and South America, we're starting to see countries leapfrog the fossil fuel generation to go directly to things like solar panels and that distributed energy. There is a huge amount of uncertainty, though, and I think that partly why we continue to hear these arguments that solar is additive and not replacing fossil fuel. I guess the other thing is that solar panels, the cost of solar panels, the cost of batteries are likely to continue to fall in the future. The price of gas won't. We know that most of the cheap reserves internationally and in Australia have been developed. Gas producers are increasingly moving to more marginal gas fields. They're more expensive to develop. So on the one hand, we have solar and battery prices falling, and then gas prices and oil prices on the other side increasing. I think that provides a lot of context for where we're likely to end up in the longer term.
Josh, you mentioned gas, and I know that your institute's done quite a lot of work on the LNG supply in WA, on Woodside's WA Browse project. What do you think are the implications for projects like that one, given what's contained in this report?
So one of the key things I took away from the new IEA report, and this is in oil and gas, the tension between the price that gas and oil producers need in order to bring on new gas supply versus the price that is needed to drive new demand. And so what I mean is, for instance, if we look at, say, the use of LNG to generate electricity and to push coal out of the mix in Asia, the IEA finds that that price would need to be about $5 per unit of LNG per MMBTUs, the technical unit. That's a pretty low price. So the IEA assumes for LNG a long-term price of $7.50. When we look at Woodside's Browse project, we build a detailed financial cost model to look at that particular project. And we estimate that it will have a LNG cost of $6.80, and that's in WA. You then need to get that to end users. You need to put ownership and pay for that. And so we actually forecast that for Woodside, the price that they would need is actually likely to be higher than the long-term LNG price forecast that the IEA has put out. So in other words, that project starts to look really, really shaky on a financial basis.
Just finally, this is, of course, your field of expertise. I'm wondering, how does it feel for you to watch a fair slice of the Australian political spectrum now talk about replacing targets for net zero with aspirations? Is this just a reality check, or is it a crisis of confidence in terms of the direction Australia has been taking?
Look, I suspect it's more a political decision. One thing we do know is that investors, you know, these are the companies who are lining up to actually put money into renewables and into energy projects. Generally, these investors, what they really want is investment certainty. So you can have a policy that may not be quite as good as what they would like, but if they're certain that policy is going to stick around, they can work around that. When we say we look at the 2010s, for instance, there was a lack of stable energy policy, and that really did hit investment in a way that I think has actually contributed partly to the high prices that we see now. So I think that the key issue here, and one of the key issues with the ongoing debate is that if you're an investor and you're looking at, say, a big wind project or a solar project or a battery project, or even a new gas project, how can you make a decision and how can you convince your board to go and spend $500 million if you don't know what the government's policy is going to be in 5 years or 10 years' time? And so this is a real concern, and it's likely, in my view, to mean that we don't get as much investment as really we need to transition our energy system in a way that provides reliability and security and that minimises the price that households pay for their electricity.
I guess that's particularly true then too if there's no bipartisan agreement on net zero, for example, if you have one side of politics saying here's the target we're going to head toward and we'll have policies to match that, and you have the other side of politics saying we're not interested in targets at all, those kinds of investors that you're talking about, people and companies for whom these projects have a 10-year planning stage or a 15-year planning stage, that must make the whole business of investing in a project in Australia really problematic.
Yeah, look, exactly. And I mean, ambitions are nice, but that still doesn't give you that investment certainty. And really, from an investor's point of view, what they're likely to do in this situation is actually just add effectively a risk premium to their investment. What does that mean? Actually, it means that they need a higher return. And what that translates into generally is just higher prices, effectively. You get a higher return by having higher revenue, and you get that just by charging consumers more. So if it's in the electricity space, say it's a battery project, you might actually bid into the electricity system at higher prices. And if you're the marginal supplier, that effectively sets the electricity price for that period. That, of course, flows straight through to consumers.
Josh, thanks so much for sharing your insights today.
Thank you.
That's Josh Runciman of the Institute for Energy, Economics and Financial Analysis. That's it from me. Thanks for your company today. I hope you can join us tomorrow when I speak to Rob Lethen about how Meta is profiting from scam ads. Before we go, though, here's a song by Mariam Rahmani. She's an Iranian santur player. It's a Persian musical instrument played by striking metal strings with small wooden hammers. This is her song Sabur, meaning patient. Have a lovely evening.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.